Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Sex discrimination, Second Amendment gun rights, the separation of church and state, and religious freedom. Some of the themes we'll be exploring this hour as we go through some of the most significant cases to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us to do that, two legal scholars. Tony Goggin is with us of Drake University, where he is professor of law and Kern Family Chair in Law. Tony, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
Tony in our Des Moines studio. Paul Gowder is with us as well, the University of Iowa law professor and O.K. Patton Fellow in Law at the University of Iowa. Today, away from Iowa in California, where he's joining us. Paul, welcome to you.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Okay, let's dash through, so to speak, because we only have an hour, and these are filled with nuance, these cases, but we're going to boil them down so we get the essence of their stories and what the decision the High Court will be making, the arguments they'll be listening to. Tony, if we can start off with you, let's go to what is viewed as, I guess, the most important First Amendment religious freedom establishment case of this new term, Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. What is this case about?
That's right, Ben. In this case, the issue before the court is whether a Montana law that created tax credits to provide scholarships for families who send their children to private schools, including, crucially, religious schools, violated the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution by aiding religious institutions. And the case, the key fact in the case is that Montana's state constitution expressly prohibits any public financial aid, whether it be direct or indirect, to religious education. Nevertheless, in 2015, the state legislature enacted a state tax credit program to repay donations made to school scholarship organizations that supported private education. After that law was passed, the State Department of Revenue heard testimony that 9 out of 10 of the beneficiaries who'd be eligible for the tax credit would use those funds to support religious education. And so the State Department of Revenue promulgated a rule disqualifying religious schools from receiving this tax credit-supported funding, and the Department of Revenue pointed to the state constitution as the reason why. And that's what led to this lawsuit. A group of parents of children in religious schools who want to be able to use the tax credits filed suit and said their religious freedom is burdened by this law.
So yeah, spin that out a little bit more, the arguments on each side. First, on the parents who are saying their religious freedom is being discriminated against, what do you imagine their arguments would be before the court?
This is a novel case in some respects, but it's following on the heels of a Supreme Court case 2 years ago, which actually we talked about here, Ben, 2 years ago, and it's the Trinity Lutheran Church v. Comer case, in which the Supreme Court held that Missouri's policy of excluding churches from a program to provide grants, if you recall, the grants were to resurface playgrounds. The U.S. Supreme Court held that that violated the Constitution because it denied this church an otherwise available public benefit on account of its religious status. Now, the one thing about Trinity Lutheran was the Supreme Court was very careful in that case in a footnote to say that essentially readers should not read too much into its decision and that the court was reserving judgment on a whole range of other questions about the scope of the religious establishment and free exercise clauses of the Constitution. But basically, the challengers here are saying they're in a similar position. They're being denied access to something that is otherwise a public benefit that they should be able to receive, but they're not being able to receive it solely because they want to use it for religious schools. So that's the heart of their argument.
Paul, chime in on this case. What are your thoughts here about this case coming before the High Court?
Yeah, I mean, so the thing about this case is it's really deep. I mean, so the reason I say that is because part of the problem that the courts have been struggling with for as long as we've had the First Amendment is there's a kind of apparent tension between the two religious liberty clauses. On the one hand, there's the idea underlying the Establishment Clause, which, depending on who you talk to, is something about government neutrality around religion or separation between government and religion. And, you know, there's the idea of the Free Exercise Clause, which is the of government not standing in the way of religion. And it's cases like this where the court is really going to have to be asked to thread a needle between, on the one hand, the idea that certainly Montana can guarantee its own unwillingness to participate in the establishment of religion by prohibiting the use of state funds, and on the other hand, the idea that, if nothing else, religious non-discrimination means treating believers and treating religious belief on similar terms, treating non-belief or treating secularism. It's just a really fundamentally constitutionally fraught issue.
Mm-hmm. Do either of you know, with the current court makeup, a conservative majority? Tony, you first. Do you have a sense of how this will come out or not?
I don't. In part, because, Ben, when the court in 2017 heard Trinity Lutheran, it was actually a large majority of the court that found that this was an infringement on Trinity Lutheran Church's rights, this denial of the grant program to resurface playgrounds. And that meant is two of the justices who are left of center, Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer, agreed with the conservatives. So this is just exactly as Paul said, this is a really difficult area of constitutional law because there is this inherent apparent tension between the two different religious clauses in the First Amendment. And so I think it's a little bit unpredictable. I think most, I think probably most observers believe that the court will follow a similar approach to Trinity Lutheran, but Justice Kavanaugh is new to the court. And so I don't know that it's certain which way it will come out.
Mm-hmm. Paul, are you any more certain?
Oh, no. I mean, so I think we've talked about this before on the show, actually. Anybody who claims to have a crystal ball about the Supreme Court, especially in these kinds of fraud cases, is just lying to you, right? I mean, it's, you know, the court is legendarily good at surprising us, and perhaps even it has an easier time surprising constitutional law professors than ordinary people because we have a sort of built-in inability to see past our own approach to the Constitution. So I'm not even going to try.
Okay.
I agree with Paul 100%.
Paul Gauder with us of the University of Iowa College of Law. Tony Goggin of the Drake University Law School. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's move on. Paul, if you can set the scene on Bostock. Bostock v. Clayton County. Actually, it's a number of cases, right, that all deal with sex discrimination that the high court has taken on. Tell us about these.
Absolutely. Now, sort of skipping over the slightly diverse facts, the key issue in all of these cases is this. So Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which is the provision prohibiting employment discrimination by private employers, has one of the prohibitions is against discrimination because of sex. And so over the years, the scope of that clause has been understood to cover obviously things like, you know, women not appreciated in this job. It's been used to cover sexual harassment. Interestingly, it's been used to cover the idea of discrimination on the basis of sex stereotypes in a case that's particularly important in the current situation, the Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins, I believe. But today, or this term, what the court is asked to consider is the extent to which discrimination because of sex includes discrimination against gay, lesbian, and bisexual persons, and discrimination against transgender persons. And really the idea here is that you can think of it as a tension between what the plain language of the statute says and what the people who passed the statute almost certainly meant, right? On the one hand, logically speaking, it's really hard to see how discrimination against a transgender person isn't discrimination because of sex, right? You know, the idea is the employer says, hey, you, I don't like the fact that you're transgendered, mm-hmm. you're fired. The employee says, well, wait a minute, what you're really doing is you're saying that I was born with a sexual, you know, morphology of one gender, but my identity is a different gender. And so what you're doing is you're firing me because my sexual morphology doesn't match the way that I behave. That's sex discrimination. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, right, at the time that Title VII was enacted, well, it's a little bit complicated. There are alternate history stories about the enactment of Title VII, but at least a relatively simplistic approach is, if they meant anything by it, they meant not discriminating against women on the basis of conventional patriarchal views about mm-hmm. the appropriateness of women in the workplace. And so the court is really going to have to decide on the basis of what style of interpretation to interpret the statute.
So it comes down to those three words, you may not discriminate because of, quote, because of sex. So what does because of sex mean here?
Exactly.
Tony, this can also be interpreted as what it means in terms of sexual preferences, sexual identity. We're not just talking about biology, right?
Right. Yeah, this is about orientation ultimately. And it, just as Paul said, it raises really interesting questions of statutory interpretation, because certainly, as Paul said, when Congress adopted this language over half a century ago, their intent would have been to deal with gender discrimination. But then there's the question of whether we only look at the intent of the statute, or we look at the common public meaning of the word at the time that was adopted.
Mm-hmm.
What did sex mean in 1964? And then there's the issue of whether a word in a statute can expand over time to include new concepts, even if the statute itself hasn't been amended. And there certainly has been a sea change in public attitudes towards gays and lesbians in American life. In the 1960s, discrimination against gays and lesbians was at epidemic levels. It was absolutely vicious and ferocious and entrenched. And yet we've seen in the last 20 years, public opinion polls have shown an extraordinary change in public opinion. And we now see a clear majority of Americans believe that discrimination against gays and lesbians it should be outlawed. And so is a change in public opinion sufficient to free the court to think differently about what a word means in a statute? Or is this something that has to be left to Congress to amend itself? And that is certainly at issue in this case, and it's something the justices are going to have to resolve.
Paul Gauder, let me ask you about these cases. Tony just outlined the huge change in public opinion across our country on this topic, but we've had two new conservative Supreme Court justices join the bench. So do they need to agree? How much do they pay attention to public opinion? Are they bound by that in any way? Does it influence them?
Again, you know, some of that is crystal ball. I mean, what I will say is that the Supreme Court, so public opinion can fit into Supreme Court cases in a few ways. So one is on the basis of just sheer politics, right? That is, there's the idea that the Supreme Court can't really diverge too far from public opinion, because ultimately it's the political process that decides who gets put on the court. It's the political process that decides whether the decisions of the court get enforced. In a statutory case like this, right, I mean, ultimately the true test of political will is Congress could act. Right? So in principle, if it's really true that there's a kind of bipartisan national consensus that employment discrimination against gays, lesbians, and bisexuals and employment discrimination against transgender persons is wrong, which I certainly think we're moving toward, then Congress has the last word on this matter. But there's also a question. One of the things that the Supreme Court does sometimes when it interprets statutes, and again, this is really more prominent in the constitutional context, but also does matter in the statutory context, is it does say, okay, our understanding of some of these concepts has shifted on the later, well, not, I guess, the retired Justice Kennedy, perhaps most famous for this kind of approach, and this idea of an understanding of conceptual and moral change can really fit into the way the court sees the meaning of the law over time.
Let's try to tackle one more case before we have to take a break. Tony, I want to have you give the basics on this case that is Trump v. NAACP and McElhinney, I think, v. Vidal and the Department of Homeland Security v. Regents of the University of California. Anyway, this all has to do with the DACA policy. This is the immigration policy introduced by Barack Obama that allows some individuals with an unlawful presence in the U.S. after being brought to the country as children to receive a renewable 2-year period of deferred action from deportation, and they become eligible for work, a work permit here in the U.S. What is this case about, Tony?
Well, I think you put it really well, Ben. This is something that ultimately affects well over 500,000 people. In fact, it may be as many as 700,000 people whose status in the United States will be potentially determined definitively by this case. The heart of this is that the Obama administration, as you indicated, in 2012, concluded that it was good public policy to temporarily defer the removal of, in particular, young people who'd been brought to the United States as children and who knew only the United States as home. And therefore, in what was essentially a type of prosecutorial discretion, the Department of Homeland Security under the Obama administration notified people in this category that their removal, though their removal would be authorized by law, the administration was choosing not to remove them. And in 2017, when the Trump administration took office, they did a review of DACA, and they concluded that it was unlawful, that the governing statute didn't authorize the administration to engage in this type of discretionary temporary deferral program. And therefore, the Trump administration's Department of Homeland Security announced that it would wind down DACA, but it would do so in an orderly fashion because obviously so many people had been relying on the 2012 policy adopted by the Obama administration. And once the administration made the Trump administration made the announcement that it was bringing DACA to an end, various plaintiffs filed suit in federal courts in different parts of the country, in D.C., New York, and California. And two courts issued nationwide preliminary injunctions to prevent the administration from winding down DACA. Mm-hmm. And so the administration is in a position where they're not able to act until they get a definitive ruling from the Supreme Court as to whether or not his policy is lawful.
Mm-hmm. So explain a little bit more, Tony, on the arguments you imagine will be put before the court here.
I think this is going to come down to two things. On the one hand, the plaintiffs are emphasizing, they're saying that this is an arbitrary and capricious policy and that it has violated the equal protection rights and really the due process rights of all the people who were benefiting from this program. And at the heart of that, I think, is the argument that the Department of Homeland Security hasn't adequately considered the reliance interests, which means the idea that we have hundreds of thousands of people who structured their affairs, whether they're going to school or getting a job, mm-hmm. on the assumption that they'd be able to renew their DACA benefits, mm-hmm. and that the administration has acted, this is the legal argument, that the administration's acted in an arbitrary fashion in pulling the rug out from underneath them. That's the heart, I think, of the plaintiff's challenge to this termination of DACA.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the Trump administration would argue, what, this is an executive decision and presidents are allowed as executive rulings, decisions.
I think the Trump administration would make even a stronger argument. What they're saying is, hey, DACA was unlawful in the first place the Obama White House should never have done this. We're now dealing with the second and third order effects of it, and we are not pulling the rug out underneath everybody because we've announced to them we're going to do this, and we're basically slowly resisting or terminating the program. And of course, I think they knew that they were going to face this reliance argument, and that's why they've announced this. This idea that they're winding the program down in an orderly fashion. But it's ultimately going to be up to the Supreme Court to decide whether or not this is being implemented by the administration in an orderly fashion.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple minutes, not quite enough time to get into the next case. We'll do that in the second half hour. But Paul, I think it would interest us, for those of us not in the legal field, to know what's going on at the Supreme Court right now. We have Is it the new term that's beginning? And these are all cases, some of the cases we're talking about, the most high-profile ones, but these are cases that the U.S. Supreme Court has chosen. On what basis does the High Court choose cases anyway?
Yeah, well, so the High Court chooses cases ultimately on the basis of what four justices want to hear, right? So the principle is almost on. There are very few cases where the Supreme Court doesn't have a choice, but effectively in all of the Supreme Court's cases, they come by a procedure known as certiorari, which essentially means that a litigant petitions the court to hear the case, and the court can decide whether it does so or not. If they get four justices who agree that the case is worth hearing, then they'll hear it. And conventionally, what we say is that the decision is governed by principles such as, I mean, importance is one of the obvious ones, you know, the idea that if a case really has a substantial effect on the legal system, if, for example, it's about, you know, a major dispute about power between the president and Congress. Another common criterion is whether or not the lower courts have disagreed. If there's, you know, the Tenth Circuit thinks one thing and the Fourth Circuit thinks something different, then the Supreme Court is more likely to see the need to step in order to resolve this disagreement so that federal law can be consistent across the country. But I think ultimately there's also a strong sense that there are a lot of considerations of prudence that go into these decisions. You know, the court sometimes wants to stay out of truly ferocious social conflicts rather than undermine its own kind of institutional legitimacy.
Paul Gauder, stay with us, joining us from California. He's professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Tony Galgan is in our Des Moines studio. He's at Drake University, professor of law there as well. Join our conversation. Your questions about the cases before the High Court or questions about how the Supreme Court works. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, we'll talk about some criminal cases before the High Court with Paul and Tony. Back in just a moment, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, today with legal scholars Paul Gauder of the University of Iowa College of Law, Tony Galgan of Drake University's Law School. They're helping us understand the cases to be heard in the coming weeks and months by the U.S. Supreme Court, talking about the implications, the arguments on each side of these cases, also how these rulings might change our society. Depending on how they're decided. If you'd like to join our conversation with your questions about these cases or how the High Court works, 1-866-780-9100. Paul, let me turn to you before we get to the criminal cases to talk about this case, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Inc. v. City of New York. This is a Second Amendment guns rights case. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is a kind of tangled case. So the original issue that was coming before the court was that at the time, as of, the last few years since Heller, for District of Columbia versus Heller and then McDonald versus Chicago, the Supreme Court held successively, first of all, that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms and that that right has something to do with individual self-defense. And second, that that right also applies to the states. And then it sort of fell silent for a while. The lower courts really struggle to figure out, okay, what exactly is included in the Second Amendment right to bear arms? Under what kind of a test should we examine regulations? I mean, obviously, there are lots of good reasons for states to enact regulations against arms. You know, nobody wants to see people driving around the street in tanks. But what are the standards which weapons regulations can be judged? And so this was really set to be a case where the court would hopefully provide some clarity on that. The issue in this case was New York City had enacted a ban on transporting handguns to shooting range out to shooting ranges outside of the city. But then developments intervened, and particularly the city repealed some of these regulations. And so then the city showed up to the court and said, actually, this case is moot. Mootness is an idea. The federal courts are only allowed to rule on what are called cases and controversies, where there's a real live issue where the parties might actually get some kind of concrete relief. And so if the regulations prohibiting transporting guns to gun ranges are no longer applicable, then the city argues the case is just moot. There's no relief for the court to grant anymore, and so it should be dismissed. And then there are some fairly complex legal issues surrounding that.
Okay, so this has to do – so why is this case then before the high court? It's not moot. It is active, and let's say I want to take my gun. I live in a city that has certain regulations about their guns, but I still want to go outside to a shooting range.
It might be moot. In other words, they're arguing about whether it's moot right now. There's briefing on that. But the idea is that, whether or not some other party might have a case in some other jurisdiction. The problem is, for the purpose of mootness law, that typically the person who's actually before the court has to have a case. In other words, the individual who brought the lawsuit has to have a case against the defendant who the lawsuit is brought against. And so the real wiggle with mootness is there's a principle known as voluntary cessation that says, okay, defendants can't just make a case moot by stopping and doing the thing that it's sued over, or else people could just get rid of lawsuits against them kind of at will. But traditionally, that rule isn't applied to government repealing regulations, the idea being we can usually rely on the repeal of some kind of governmental enactment to be a bit firmer, just some defendant stopping doing something and picking it up again. But there's also another really striking thing about this case, which is that Sheldon Whitehouse and a number of other Democratic senators filed this incredibly controversial friend of the court brief a while back, and it essentially saying to the court, that this case is political and you shouldn't even decide it, because if you decide it, it's going to drastically undermine your legitimacy. And so really sort of saying the unspoken things, that it's really sort of considered, tasteless if not problematic to say about the idea that the court is a political entity and claiming that it should take into those considerations into account.
Tony, comment on this case, especially the aspect here for gun owners. Does this have, depending on whether the mootness is established or not, this case goes forward and is decided, what might be the implications for gun owners?
Right, Ben. I agree with Paul. completely about the mootness issue. However, if the case does go forward, if the court ultimately concludes that New York City changed the regulation solely for the purpose of evading review, and the court doesn't grant deference to the fact that we're dealing with a government entity here, and the fact that New York City repealed these provisions in their regulations just 2 months ago, and they clearly did so with an eye on avoiding U.S. Supreme Court review, because they had actually won at the Intermediate Court of Appeals. So they had reason to think they had a strong case, except for the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court's been moving in a pro-gun rights direction, at least it did in the two cases that Paul referred to. But the catch is this. If this case gets to the merits, it's going to come down to what does the word bear mean in the Second Amendment? The phrase is right to keep and bear arms. Mm. The Heller case from Washington, D.C. a decade ago turned on the issue of what the word keep means. As Paul said, the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment confers an individual right to keep and bear arms. But Heller was about a D.C., Washington, D.C. regulation that put very heavy, onerous burdens on the right to have a handgun in your house. This puts before the court the reach of the word bear. Bear refers to the idea of transporting something, and what the challengers are arguing is that New York's restrictions and their ability to transport their firearms, in particular their handguns, outside the city violates their Second Amendment right to bear arms. And the city, in response, basically surrendered. And they surrendered so on the eve of the Supreme Court hearing this case. And so I think that's a pretty good sign that the city thought they were going to lose. Mm. And they feared that this case could give rise to a sweeping pro-gun rights ruling by the Supreme Court that could ultimately invalidate hundreds of other gun restrictions around the country. And so I think if the court does get to the merits of this case, it could be a blockbuster. It could be one that really has a big impact on the Second Amendment across the country.
Mm. Okay. Tony Goggin is with us, Drake University Law School, Paul Gowder of the University of Iowa College of Law, if you've just joined us. Let's finish up with try to encapsulate three criminal cases before the high court as we work through the docket on the U.S. Supreme Court, the new term about to start, or has it? None of these cases, I believe, have been heard, correct, Tony?
Right.
So the beginning of October traditionally is when the high court convenes to start hearing these cases, and then it works its way through the new year into, I guess, May. End of May is when we typically hear the decisions on some of the most controversial cases. Is that more or less how it works?
That's right. In June, June has actually been lately the month where many of the most blockbuster decisions are announced.
Okay. Let's go to these criminal cases. Tony, tell us about this case. Is it Collar v. Kansas? Whether a state may eliminate any defense of insanity to criminal charges. And there's something that if you've been around a few decades, you remember people complete insanity, right?
Right. And indeed, this case, the underlying facts of this case arise from a horrible mass murder in Kansas 10 years ago. And what happened is a state court jury convicted Collar of burglary and capital murder for fatally shooting his estranged wife and her mother, or her grandmother, and her two daughters, who they were also his daughters, at the grandmother's home on Thanksgiving weekend 2009. But the key fact in this case was that during the attack, he intentionally spared his 9-year-old son's life. Thus, he only targeted his female relatives. At trial, the defendant admitted to the murders, but he raised a defense that severe depression rendered him incapable, in his view, of forming the intent and premeditation necessary for a charge of capital murder. And the state, in response, pointed to the fact that he chose to spare his son's life and specifically targeted his female relatives as evidence of his culpable mental state at the time of the mass killing. The jury agreed and convicted him of capital murder. On appeal, one of the arguments Collar is making is that the Kansas state law had been changed to limit the circumstances in which he could raise a defense of mental disease or defect. In particular, Kansas had changed its law to say that, quote, it is a defense to a prosecution under any statute that the defendant, as a result of mental disease or defect, lacked the mental state required, and here's the key phrase, as an element of the offense charged. But the statute states that mental disease or defect is not otherwise a defense. So basically, you have to show not only that you were suffering from a mental disease or defect, you have to be able to connect it directly to the elements of the crime you're charged with, or the intent element. And he argues that this violated his due process rights because, in his view, it effectively abolished the insanity defense, whereas the state argued in response that we didn't abolish the insanity defense. We're just putting some restrictions on how you're allowed to raise it.
Mm. And it's interesting also, Tony, comment on why we don't hear much about the insanity defense anymore. I think I'm recalling correctly in the 70s, maybe even into the 80s, we heard quite a number of those.
Oh, in fact, it goes back to the 1800s. President Garfield was assassinated, of course, in 1881 by a man named Charles Guiteau. And Guiteau was, without question, seriously ill, mentally ill at the time that he shot President Garfield. Guiteau had no role in the 1880 presidential campaign, but he'd believed that he was the reason that Garfield had won, and he wanted a position in the Garfield administration. He even went to the jail before the assassination, went to the D.C. jail, and pronounced the accommodations were excellent. So this was a person who was obviously very troubled, and his defense attorneys raised the defense that he was insane, lacked the mental capacity necessary to form the intent and premeditation for capital murder. That defense did not succeed, and Guiteau was executed for killing President Garfield. But the bottom line is this is a defense we've seen in American courts for 140 years. And again, Kansas, at least Kansas' argument is they're not getting rid of it. They're just putting some limits on how defense attorneys can raise that defense.
Mm. Okay. Well, let's, Paul, there in California, I know you have to go off to teach a class. I wonder if you could walk us through one more of these cases, one more of these criminal cases, Ramos v. Louisiana, before you do go off to teach your class, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ramos v. Louisiana is another murder case, but this one raises actually a really baseline constitutional issue. Up until, I believe recently, Louisiana amended the statute, but up until then, and certainly when this case occurred, Louisiana did not require unanimous jury verdicts to secure a criminal conviction. It required 10 rather than all 12 jurors. And I believe Louisiana and maybe Oregon are the only states.
Regardless of the crime, including homicide.
Exactly, which was one of these cases. And so under federal law, if the court applies the Sixth Amendment, you know, federal juries are constitutionally required under the way that the Sixth Amendment has been interpreted to be unanimous in these types of cases. So the issue before the court is, does that Sixth Amendment requirement apply to the states as well? And it's a really strange situation because by now, and particularly, actually, this connects to the gun rights issue because in McDonald versus Chicago, the court actually confronted a claim by the city that, hey, the Second Amendment, sure, the Second Amendment applies to the states in some form, but it doesn't necessarily have to apply in the same way that it applies to the federal government. And the court said, no, we've decided that when we incorporate the protection of the Bill of Rights against the states, when we say that the 14th Amendment makes the Bill of Rights apply to a state, we mean that any particular provision of the Constitution that we incorporate is going to be incorporated the way that it applies to the federal government. And so the issue before the court in this case is, does that apply to the Sixth Amendment's jury trial right? Admitting that the Sixth Amendment jury trial right applies to the states, does the court have to interpret it for the states to mean unanimous jury verdicts like they applied it to the federal government, or can they have a different interpretation?
Mm-hmm. And your sense of how this will go out, is this another crystal ball for you?
I actually think this one's relatively easy. It's sort of widely recognized that the Sixth Amendment unanimity requirement is an aberration. Even just this year, the Supreme Court did another incorporation case, said that the excessive fines clause of the Eighth Amendment applies to the states, and there was no sense that it would apply in different terms from the way it applies to the federal government. I think that the courts pretty likely to use this as an opportunity to say that the aberration is no more, and that when we incorporate an amendment, we incorporate it as the federal courts have interpreted it to apply to the federal government.
Okay, Paul, very good. I'm glad in my last gasp that I did get you to not pull out the crystal ball.
Well, now I'm almost certain to be wrong, right? I uttered a prediction about the Supreme Court on the radio. That almost guarantees that
yes.
It goes the other way.
We're making numerous copies of this conversation to haul out in the future, Paul.
And I must say, I agree with Paul's prediction. So that really means it's going to end up being wrong.
Okay. Paul, we'll let you go off to class. Thank you very much, Paul Gowder.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Okay. Until next time, Paul. Take care. Tony, thank you for being with us also these last few minutes to take us through one more criminal case. This is Kansas v. Glover. This is a Fourth Amendment search and seizure case.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Ben. And this is a case that has really a mundane fact pattern. It arose from a traffic stop made by a Kansas sheriff's deputy who observed a pickup truck and decided to run the truck's license plate number through the Kansas Revenue Department's database. And the deputy learned that the driver, this Mr. Glover, had registered the vehicle and that Glover's Kansas driver's license had been revoked. Now, the key point is the deputy did not observe any traffic violations by the driver, but he initiated the traffic stop anyways based on his assumption that Glover was driving the vehicle. The deputy also did not try to confirm the identity of the driver before he pulled the driver over. And the state then subsequently charged Glover, the driver, with driving as a habitual violator because he had various traffic offenses against him allegedly. He filed a motion to suppress that evidence against him, arguing that he should never have been pulled over in the first place because the officer lacked reasonable suspicion to think that he was the driver. Now, the irony here is the deputy was right. Glover was the driver. But the question is, at the time that he pulled him over, was there reasonable suspicion that Glover was the driver? And the Kansas Supreme Court said, no, there wasn't. And the court held that the stop violated the Fourth Amendment. And so what you have really is a battle between the Kansas legislature and the Kansas Supreme Court or the Kansas governor's office, because they're arguing that the stop was reasonable. And they pointed out that 12 state Supreme Courts and 4 federal intermediate courts of appeal have held that such stops are constitutional because there's enough there when you run plates and find out that the owner has some hold on their record that authorizes pulling them over, that's reasonable.
Mm. Tony, we have just a minute or so left, but to my non-legal mind, at least not schooled in these areas, I would think that if a vehicle is registered to someone, it is reasonable for a police officer to think that is the person driving it. I don't know, but how do you feel about it?
I think that's right, except what's interesting is in the briefing, it's been pointed out that it's very common for a family automobile to have multiple members of the family drive it, both two spouses and maybe an adult child or a 17, 18-year-old. A lot of people are covered by that scenario.
Right, but that doesn't rule out the fact that it's reasonable. If you had one guess about who's driving the car and you see it's registered to a male with this name, it's reasonable to say that male is the same person that it's registered to. I'm just saying that.
And one of the points that Kansas has emphasized is that 1 in 5 fatal car accidents in this country involves an unlicensed or invalidly licensed driver.
Okay.
So they see a public safety component here that necessitates these types of traffic stops.
Very, very interesting. Okay, we're almost done here. How excited are you about this? Which will be, in your view, the biggest case here when we come to May and June and start hearing these decisions?
Oh, I think that we're going to see a bunch more cases or during the spring term. But among these cases before us right now, I really do think that the issue of what because of sex means is the most prominent case the court's going to hear in the next couple of months.
Okay. Will we have these decisions before the end of the year?
I think we will have a number of them by the end of December and in January and early February. And then the court will be hearing a whole nother batch of cases that they'll rule on in May and June.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Tony Goggin, professor of law and Kern Family Chair in Law at Drake University. Tony, thanks so much for coming into our studio today and opening our eyes, explaining a little bit about the cases, high-profile cases before the high court.
It was my pleasure, Ben.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. Also help today from Stephanie Nobriga. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Make sure you tune in tomorrow for our Politics Day. Until then.